Pacifica Radio in San Francisco. This is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, Trump's shock troops still patrolling the streets of Portland on a mission of provocative violence. Also, Santa Cruz, California becomes a police state for the homeless. And we'll feature a brand new edition of Food Fight, the battle against hunger and homelessness in America with Food Not Bombs founder Keith McHenry. And we'll look at a protest coming up at San Quentin over the weekend. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Well, what's going on in Portland? Are those shock troops going to leave or are they going to stay? That's the question. We're going to take a close look at that right now. And we go to Portland, Oregon, where we are joined by a first-time contributor to this show and somebody who works at KBOO Community Radio. Welcome Mike Leverett. He's a contributor, organizer, activist, and he does contribute to KBOO. Welcome to Flash Points.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on today.
Well, it's good to have you with us. I've been reading, and among all the problems and concerns that local folks have in Portland, now people are starting to worry about the impact of the chemical weaponry that the shock troops are using, and that it really can alter and endanger the environment. So welcome. Why don't you give us your response to that and give us just your overview of what's been happening over the last couple of days. The troops are still there, aren't they?
Yes, they're still here. They may be here in smaller numbers, is what they tell us. But they're still here, and their presence is still felt. Last night was a different sort of feel and vibe at the protesting scene, because a lot of people thought that, the majority of them had left. So, it was a night of kind of celebrations, and it was more peaceful than previous nights. So, there's definitely a feel, a different type of feel that, they are on their way out. Is the question is just how many, because, we know the Trump administration by now, it would be not that hard to believe that they would not fulfill this agreement to pull back the federal officers, he's already said that he's going to send in the National Guard just earlier today. So it's a wait and see game, but for now we're keeping our eyes open and we're just remaining vigilant as possible. Now, in terms of what you were talking about in terms of chemical gas, it's going to have a lasting effect on a lot of people, because they were using military style tactics against us, towards the end there, I was seeing reports and hearing reports from fellow protesters and demonstrators that, the gas towards the end that they're trying to use now on us, it's got a different effect. More people are getting sicker. I saw on the scene one night, like, a lot of people were throwing up, which was different from different nights. They were just regurgitating profusely. And a lot of people are saying that they're waking up in the morning with more lingering, different effects on their body that they're feeling. So something's definitely not right. Nothing was ever right about deploying tear gas for peaceful demonstrators. But it's going to have a lasting and damaging effect on our environment, yes, and on our psyches, on our minds, mentally, because this is what America in 2020 looks like. They're still deploying tear gas on people for peacefully demonstrating. So, yeah.
Michael, we were talking the other day in terms of planning for this segment, and I was mentioning how I was traveling through the South to investigate dozens of church burnings, and I had a chance to visit in South Carolina the Klan shop. You are from South Carolina, you told me, and you witnessed the Confederate flag flying over the state house. You live down the block from the Klan shop. People in the North would be surprised that there would be a Klan shop. So there you are in Portland now. It is a mostly white neighborhood. Talk a little bit about why you think I mean, I can understand why there would be a rebellion in South Carolina, but why do you think sort of Portland is leading the charge? And it is really a mostly majority white city. There is a strong, devoted African-American community. Talk about that.
Well, you know, I think it's different from South Carolina because people are more complacent in South Carolina when it comes to racism and just old bad fears and old bad habits consist of South Carolina when it comes to racism. You know, not too long ago, let's remember that not too long ago, Jim Crow was very prominent and adamant. You know, that's what my mother had to live through. That's what my grandmother had to live through. You know, I come from descendants of slaves in Georgia and South Carolina. So, you know, unfortunately, people are complacent with that type of behavior and that type of hatefulness down there. But here, you know, it's a different story. You know, that's the reason why I moved out of South Carolina, to get away from that and move to somewhere more like here, where, you know, it's less tolerated. And you're going to have people that are going to stand up and say no to it. Now, albeit, Oregon is historically a very racist state. It has a very historically racist history. Portland is a very predominantly white city, as you said. But at the same time, you know, they are what some would call a liberal mecca of progressive minds and beliefs. And, you know, I think we sort of got put into the spotlight because when you get those good photo ops and you get those good video shots and stuff of people causing harm and in the media's opinion, causing destruction and chaos, then, you know, the attention is going to be put on our city more and more. And Trump used that as a window, I believe, to, you know, make our city as an example of why he needs to impose law and order everywhere, from here to Chicago to, you know, everywhere, basically. So, you know, it's important, and that's unfortunate, but, you know, we are resolute out here in terms of like what we want to see in terms of justice and black liberation. I mean, well, black and brown bodies are, at least. It's very different because people are just less complacent out here. People know, you know, thankfully this is a place where, you know, you're going to see Black Lives Matter yard signs in almost every yard on one block, compared to seeing rebel flags on every yard in one block, which I've had the displeasure of witnessing many times down south. So yeah, it's just about, you know, where you're located and the history of, you know, that place, and, you know, and like how are people trying to change that history, and are they trying to take the initiative of changing that history? So yes.
All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about what do you think. What did it feel like for you to be a part of this? Does it feel like for you to be a part of this? What's going through your mind? What's reverberating inside of you? What's at the heart of the matter as you're in the street, as you see what's happening, and you even see a mayor who I don't quite get, also happens to be the police commissioner. But what's it been like for you?
Well, you know, I have extensive history with organizing and demonstrating. I was, you know, I was a core member of Black Lives Matter Chicago, BYP 100 Chicago. I was in several members of groups and organizations. And Chicago has a very large, you know, presence when it comes to organizing activism. So, you know, this becomes natural to me in terms of witnessing the worst of the worst. You know, and the worst for me was when I was in Charlottesville and I was one of the only few, you know, surrounded at that statue by tiki torches and neo-Nazis, me and about 20 other people, you know, and we all thought we were going to lose our life. And then the next day I was in the road when the car plowed through the crowd and I saw people die and lose their life and loved ones injured. You know, I've seen the worst of the worst when it comes to these demonstrations and these protests. And, you know, that sort of, you know, mental just processing, it's hard because it's a lot on black bodies and minds and stuff to witness this, to see how, you know, much, you know, how much we have to fight for just basic rights, you know, just for the right to breathe. you know, we have to go out here and, you know, get tear gassed in 2020. You know what I mean? We have to have shock grenades thrown at us. You know, just because we're upset that a man was killed because he had a knee to his neck. You know, because a girl was asleep and the police squad came in and shot her to death. You know, and we can't be upset about that. You know, so it's very reminiscent of these demonstrations are very reminiscent of Charlottesville in a lot of ways for me, because the anger is very high and it's very tense. And I'm glad in some ways that it hasn't escalated to Charlottesville, but I am afraid that if we continue to have more demonstrations like this against this federal government that's underneath Trump, it will get worse and it will turn into a Charlottesville number two. Maybe not here, but in another city or another what Trump would like to call liberal city, where he feels like he needs to just deploy these federal agents and police officers, only making matters worse before he's making matters better. This is backfired on him times 10. If he thought that this was going to be something beneficial towards him and his reelection chances, well, I tell you, he did create a rousing little fire amongst his voting block and fan base. I mean, he did. He riled them up a little bit, but still, the masses and the majority were against this, and they were loud about it, and they totally see that these are people coming in using military-style tactics on innocent civilians, all because they're trying to speak about fighting for Black lives. That is problematic on so many levels, and it proves that we as a country have a long way to go in terms of fighting for Black liberation and justice for those that were lost by the hands of this corrupt police system.
Do you think the governor, the mayor, really has a clue about what's on your mind, about what might be your vision and the community's vision for a transformation away from the kind of vicious, racist policing we have seen in every part of the country?
They say they do. Ted Wheeler, I highly doubt, though. Like, Ted Wheeler is the police chief as well, and he did make the choice to send police officers onto the scene, thus creating the peak of this problem that's morphed into these federal agents now in our city. You know, it was his decision to send those police officers down there, and it came with very dire consequences. So he decided he wanted to play the brave one and go down there himself one night and be on the front lines. And you know, he was tear gassed, he was maced in the face. And he felt what it was like to be on the front line. So be it. If he wanted to play that role and wanted to see what it was like, then he got a taste of it, literally. When it comes to Kate Brown, I mean, I don't know. She's a politician like the rest of them. I really can't speak for some of these politicians, especially some of these white politicians, because you think they have your best interests. A lot of black people these days feel this way. You know, we want to think that they have our best intentions in mind, but at the end of the day, we end up disappointed. You know, we're ending up getting nowhere in terms of like comprehensive police reform that's actually going to prevent the next George Floyd or Breonna Taylor. You know, this is what we're still facing. So we have no faith in Wheeler, and we have no faith in Kate Brown right now, and it's not going to change until we actually see some action when it comes to productive police reform. But until then, we're talking to a brick wall, as we've had over for a while now. You know, black voices have been stymied and they've been silenced and they've gone unnoticed for a very long time. And the minute that we get upset or we even begin to do a peaceful protest by kneeling, by being quiet, by staying silent, by being loud, we're looked at as being, you know, just unruly and anarchist, and, you know, burning our cities down. And Kate Brown and Ted Wheeler have done very little to change that narrative of us. I've barely seen Kate Brown come out. She said some stuff in terms of support of the protest, but she hasn't been a staunch supporter of Black Lives Matter here or protests or demonstrators. In my opinion, she hasn't. And as I said, Ted Wheeler was one that decided to deploy the police down there against peaceful protests, which is the exact reason why what we're protesting against in the first place. So, no, I don't have any faith or confidence in them, and neither do a lot of other black and brown bodies that are putting their lives out there on the front line. So, yes.
it didn't seem like many people had much faith when Wheeler showed up there. I did note some interesting guerrilla theater. If you watched it on YouTube, you saw that when he was speaking through the tear gas, somebody had a police hat
that they were holding up
above his head to make the... Are you saying that was you?
No, that was not but it was
somebody had a good idea, though. Somebody made the point very clearly, and it really did look like it fit perfectly on his head.
It looked like a halo above him, yes.
Like a halo.
I agree.
Well, forgive me. But it really was good. You know, sometimes theater is the best response to something like that.
It truly is.
Well, here's the thing. I would love to keep this dialogue going, and, you know, maybe we can work at a joint broadcast where we can do live from both cities and continue to cover this. But I guess before we say goodbye to you, I want you to take a minute or two to tell us about, you know, if you were calling the shots, if you had a few decisions to make at this point, what would you want to see happen?
What I want to see is our allies and our comrades, especially white comrades, to remember that we can't get complacent. You know, protesting and demonstrating may look sexy, may look cool for the moment, or, you know, what's recently happening, but we can't just go complacent after 1 month or 2 months or 3 months or 4 months because, you know, things have died down or things have calmed down. You're not seeing police actually on video doing injustice to black and brown bodies, you know, so everything seems to be okay. You know, that narrative we need to lose that narrative. You know, this is a fight that must be battled every day. I heard a white individual at one of the demonstrations the other day say we won because they thought that they drove the feds out, the feds off that night, which they did in some ways. But, you know, she said we won. And I looked back and I was deeply bothered by that. And I was like, well who won and for what? If you're just speaking in terms of the black struggle, then no, we haven't won yet. We have a long way to go because we still have to wake up in the morning and face the fact that we have to go out of our homes and worry about our children, worry about ourselves, and worry about our well-being and our lives, you know, in the hands of these police officers. That's what we have to still wake up today, today, tomorrow, and for a while, a long time in the future, unfortunately. And that's what makes this important. And we must remain resolute in making sure that we have comprehensive police reform, that we find ways to defund the police, that we find ways to make sure that, you know, we are letting black bodies know that we have your back and we support you. We support you not just on the streets and in demonstrations, but we support you through organizational efforts, through donating to some of the causes to help black organizations and stuff uplift our impoverished communities. You know what I mean? We need to elect more black officials onto elected panels. You know what I mean? In elected positions. This is what needs to happen. We need to go deeper and farther into the root of this and get rid of this systemic systemic racism presence in this country, or nothing's going to change. You know, we've been fighting this fight for years. My grandparents have been fighting it since Jim Crow. You know, my great-grandparents and their great-grandparents, you know, all the way dating back to slavery, as I previously stated. My mother fought it also in Jim Crow. This fight is long from over. We have a long way to go, but we must remain resolute, and we must remain as one voice in this fight. And I know that we can be victorious if we just remain vigilant and consistent and resolute. And yes, so that's, I'll leave it there.
Well, 400 years is a long time. And the struggle has been going in one form or another for, oh, so many years. Michael, we really appreciate you joining us again. We hope that you will come back, keep us posted.
Thank you.
There's a lot more to say, and you also have a beautiful voice, so that works.
Thank you.
As well.
Thank you so much.
For radio. Apparently, you've been doing this a long time. So,
I was going to say, I've been editing your show ever since the old radio station I worked back in Chicago, too, as well. So I'm very familiar with your show, and I love the work that you do, so thank you.
All right. Well, I am honored, and onward we go. This is once again another beginning in the struggle for transformation. Again, we've been speaking with Michael Lavarette. He's an activist, organizer, representative for KABU Community Radio. That's an affiliate of Flashpoints. We've been on there for a long time, and again, we'll be back soon. Be careful, Michael.
Thank you. Thank you so much, everyone.
All right. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Coming up next, we're going to hear from No Justice Under Capitalism. There's going to be a San Quentin protest, and we're going to tell you something about that. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We are broadcasting from San Francisco today, and we're going to talk about an action that's happening in the Bay Area, sponsored by a group called No Justice Under Capitalism. It's a San Quentin protest. Actually, it's sponsored by several groups, and we're going to hear all about it now. We're joined by Courtney Morris and also by Sasha Lietman. Welcome both of you to Flashpoints.
Great. Thank you.
Hi, Dennis. Thanks for having us on here.
Well, it's a pleasure. Let me start with Courtney. I can't tell the difference in the voices, but it doesn't matter. Courtney, why don't you begin by talking about the it's titled No State Execution by COVID-19. Why that title?
That title because on March 13th, 2019, Gavin Newsom signed an executive direction instituting a moratorium on the death penalty in California. However, 47 deaths have occurred due to criminal state negligence since the pandemic began in prisons, which have literally become death camps. And so that is our call to action, to stay committed to ending state execution within the prison system and demanding mass releases now to mitigate the pandemic and to prevent further state failure in its handling within California prisons and jails.
It was very troubling, Courtney, to see what happened within the system. Things are never good in San Quentin, but there was no pandemic breakout until the folks in the prison system started moving prisoners around, and then it became a massive and deadly problem. And that is, I guess, part of the reason why you want to hold the governor accountable. I mean, one understands, I think the prison guards are the number one donor to political campaigns.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And indeed, it is mind-boggling that at a time when there were zero cases at San Quentin and amidst the pandemic, 121 incarcerated people were taken from Chino, one of the most COVID-stricken prisons in California, and transferred into San Quentin, resulting in over 50% of the entire prison population experiencing COVID. And to date, out of 47 deaths across California, CDCR statistics express that 70% of those deaths were people of color, 68% identified were people with mental health, cognitive, or physical disabilities, and 10 of them had release dates in 2020 or 2021. They were folks that were just about to get out. It's tragic.
Hmm. Sasha Lietman, what's at the core of this for you? What's driving you in this context?
I mean, I think that what we're seeing right now is a humanitarian crisis that's completely preventable. I mean, it's not just happenstance that incarcerated people are getting COVID and dying in such high numbers. These are some of the most vulnerable people in our society who are being forcibly confined and neglected by the state. Newsom, like, knows that he can release them. He's recently ordered 8,000 releases, which is a number that sounds big, but it's only a mere 3% reduction in the overall prison population. The UC public health experts are recommending at least a 50% decarceration. And so him saying that they're releasing only 8,000 people, I mean, it's clear that it's possible to release people and to prevent this, but, you know, 8,000 is nothing compared to what needs to happen in order to stop the prevention of...
And that's 8,000 in the middle of a very overcrowded San Quentin. I think it was, what, up to 125% of the population? So 8% doesn't even get you under 100% full.
3%. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, it's
in
ridiculous.
Fact, and 19 of 36 state prisons in California are at over 120% capacity. So, yes, why is that?
Why is that? That's a very good question, and it's a very important question because the dangers are immense, and people are foolish if they think that prisons exist in a vacuum. This is our people. These are all the people, if you will, of California who need to work together to prevent this virus. And I guess let me come back to you, Courtney, because we're running out of time. I'd love you to talk. What are the details? How can people participate? Why do you think it's important for them to participate right now?
Yeah, thank you so much for asking. So it's so important to participate now because, as Sasha mentioned, it is making a difference. You are correct in saying that, you know, Newsom, as all policymakers, are so heavily lobbied by the prison for-profit industry. And it is so important to maintain the political pressure. There was incredible protests that occurred in front of his house Monday morning, whereby, you know, 14 undocumented folks and attorneys were arrested, chained themselves to the gate. And these types of demonstrations are so important because he hadn't even committed to releasing any incarcerated folks until protest after protest were occurring. So we got some people out. 8,000 folks are being released too late. However, we need to demand more. So please show up. I know there's a pandemic. We will be practicing social distancing. We will have on masks. Please show up to the Larkspur Ferry Terminal this Sunday at 12 o'clock. We will be marching 0.9 miles to the west gate of San Quentin, and we will be holding our rally there with a ton of system-impacted families speaking, performing poetry, performing music. I think it's going to be a beautiful event. If you want to contribute but you can't show up, please hit us up on social media, Facebook and Instagram, No Justice Under Capitalism, and on Venmo, No Justice Under Capitalism. It does cost money to get a permit at the terminal. It does cost money to bring food and water. Bring food, bring water, bring yourselves. We appreciate you.
All right. Well, listen, we would like to get a report back. I hope it goes well. And you are asking people to show up where and when?
So again, at the Larkspur Ferry Terminal at 12 o'clock on Sunday, August 2nd. Once gathered, we will be marching up Sir Francis Drake Boulevard up to the west gate of San Quentin in Larkspur.
All right. Please come back and give us a report back. We appreciate the incredibly important life and death work you are doing. And really, it would be no big deal for them to open up those gates and release at least 50% of the people. We're talking about people, usually they say over 65, but when you're in prison, you're aging faster. So people are vulnerable at 50. We know from the statistics that folks over 50 who are let out of jail don't tend to commit crime again. So the whole thing is really unnecessary death trap. And if we were a humane society, we would really open up the gates. Thanks both for joining us on Flashpoints.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis.
You're welcome. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. I am going to skip the music, or... Yes. And I think we're joined by Keith McHenry. Are you there, Keith?
Yep, I'm here. Dennis, yeah.
It's time.
I've been on the scene. So it's pretty
Let me just say it's time again for our... weekly segment, Food Fight with Keith McHenry. This is a segment about fighting for against houselessness and for the rights of the poor and the disinherited in this country. Right now, the situation in Santa Cruz is a mess, and really it's a microcosm about what's going on in cities and towns all across this country in the context of the homeless. Keith, lay this out for us. I hope we got a clear line here. Go on. What's happening? Keith?
On this area. Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, speak up, please.
Yeah, we received a phone call from people living outside in this area called the Benchlands. And at that location, they said that there's all of a sudden all these fencing coming in. That was like 2 days ago. So hundreds and hundreds of feet, hundreds of yards, really, of fence around this park. And then they started, they put essentially an internment camp in the middle, another fenced in area, and put about 60 little pup tents with cots and sleeping bags. And they are telling people that they have to either be in there or they have to leave the area altogether. And that's what the second fence, the outer perimeter fence, is to keep people from returning back. So the other thing that happened is they started fencing off places around downtown where they thought those that didn't want to be in this camp with rules, and people right now they're saying you can come and go whenever you want, but we've seen in the past that policy changes over time. So a lot of people are reluctant to go into this camp. In the past also, they've not provided drinking water and very little in the way of resources, including no way to charge your phones, things like that. And it seems to me, from what I've been seeing, that they're the same issue in this camp. And it's got this kind of fascistic atmosphere to it, because no one is being consulted. The community's not being consulted. The people that are having to live under these conditions are not being consulted. And in short, it's pretty clear that the city, rather than put people in hotel rooms, is going to spend $6 a foot for fencing, and that's their policy, or $4 a foot for fencing if it doesn't have the screen around it to block the view. And it's really a shame. The other thing that's happening is that the shelter downtown in Watsonville turned out to have COVID, and they had to shut the shelter down. And that's one of the places people are supposed to get sent to if they're not going to be, in this 60-person tent city behind this chain link fence. And so, unfortunately, they found out about COVID in that shelter by accident, when somebody that was going to an unrelated surgery was tested positive, and they found out people in that shelter were also tested positive, and that's why they had to shut it down. But in this county, the people that are spend a week or two in that shelter, spend a couple of weeks maybe in another shelter, and move around as they get kicked out of one shelter to the other. And so if it was in that shelter, it's probably spread throughout all the shelters in the Santa Cruz area.
Keith, we're running out of time. What's your concern now? What's your worst fear about where this is going? I mean, I don't know where Gavin Newsom's incredible program that he keeps talking about in terms of here you are in a city full of empty hotel rooms, motel rooms, and, you know, you're being fenced in. You're being pushed to a place where there's an outbreak. Now they're going to have to close that center down. Give us your last best shot here, and we'll be back soon.
Yeah, well, my fear is that they're conditioning people to believe that they don't really have any agency as homeless people, that they're trying to get people living on the streets. And, of course, we'll know that, you know, it's likely that the population is going to double of homeless people in Santa Cruz, and that if this is the solution now, what will it be in the future? And there's a certain kind of fascistic atmosphere to this, where it's cops and fences and not a lot of resources in a tremendously wealthy community. And it just shows this idea that this is the other, that these are there was a woman today that was just shaking her head, waiting for a bus, and she kept saying, "This is like the Holocaust. This is like the Holocaust." And it's certainly not like the Holocaust, but just for an unhoused person to have expressed that in viewing this, and she wasn't even being forced into this particular area. She was already living in the woods in another part of town. And it's really, really sad. So, and it appears to be that it's just plain going to be illegal to be a homeless, unhoused person outside of some official facility where you're monitored, where you're ID'd, and where you must gain permission to come and go. And that's what's very, very sad, that that's already being conditioned into the community here. But there are a lot of people pushing back and refusing to cooperate and just packing up and walking away from this entire program that the city's trying to put forth.
Well, as you say, Keith, there's going to be a lot more people. Congress is not acting. The eviction moratorium seems to be over, even if it's not officially over. There will be people they are expecting many more people in the street. 35,000 people. What did I say that? What's the figure? How many million? 30,
okay, they're
35.
Saying that it could be 28 million people are facing eviction in September. We'll start to see a lot of people getting the three-day notices and believing that means 3 days and being hitting the streets. We're already seeing people that have been displaced and evicted on the streets, even during the moratorium, because there's plenty of ways to get rid of people out of their housing. And the other thing is people go, well, don't the landlords want to rent to somebody? Well, sadly, the amount of housing that is actually owned by a landlord that actually cares is diminishing dramatically, because housing is often owned by shell companies. And therefore, it's the actual building that's important to them, not whether people are paying rent. And we're seeing that already in Santa Cruz. And I'm sure we're going to see that across the country. And it's, I think, you know, we're trying to get the population here of housed people to, one, resist leaving their homes if faced with eviction, and two, to start stepping up to respond to the fact that, you know, we're cooking every single day and feeding people every single day, and it's incredibly difficult just to handle the 150 to 200 people a day that we're supporting, and to get to 400, 500 people a day, 600 people a day. It's just going to be overwhelming. And so we need to pull the whole community together just to handle fresh water, because we are the fresh water. This county and the city are not providing fresh water. And we are often the meals. Thankfully, there are Meals on Wheels and some programs that the county are paying for. But by and large, it's just the people are just left to their own devices, or their succumbing to having to be essentially in a minimum security prison just to survive.
All right. Well, listen, Keith, we are glad that you're on the ground. If people want to get in touch with Food Not Bombs, how do they do that?
Well, you can call us at 1-800-884-1000. 1136, and that's the hunger hotline that can be found on foodnotbombs.net. And if you have no money, you can just walk up to any payphone and dial that number, and we will do our best to hook you up with a local meal. Or if you want to help volunteer in any of the over 1,000 chapters that we have worldwide and in any of the countries, you might be hearing either a rebroadcast of this or currently listening to it. We'd love your support. And Food Not Bombs is, it's often we are one of the lifelines in communities in places like Burma or in the Philippines, Indonesia, those kind of places. It's England, even people in England are like really struggling, and Food Not Bombs is on trying to meet people's needs there. So this is like,
well, Keith, we're going to be back. We're going to be back to you next week. We're just against the clock here.
I understand.
We do thank you for joining us. We will talk to you next week. Keith McHenry, Food Not Bombs, incredibly courageous visionary who has been with this for 40 years. Thanks, Keith.
Thank you so much, Dennis. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And you are listening to Flashpoints. In a moment, we're going to take a short break. Some of you are going to hear Chris Hedges, and others are going to hear Miguel Gavilán Molina and myself. Stay tuned.
It could be argued that we are now in the midst of a coup d'etat in slow motion. Democracy is weakening. Corporatism is strengthening. Yet none of us has chosen this route for our society, in spite of which our elites, quite happily, continue down it.
This is a multi-lane highway, a kind of savage laceration that runs directly over the center of Camden, New Jersey, so that commuters in and out of Philadelphia never have to see this city, this sacrifice zone. And that's what we've done. We've rendered those trapped in these sacrifice zones invisible. These people have been not just rendered invisible through infrastructure, but they've been rendered invisible through a media which doesn't report their stories at all. And we should also note that they're completely trapped. They can't get loans. Rents are actually quite high in Camden, although you're living in dilapidated conditions. And this was one of the major manufacturing centers of the United States. You used to have RCA Victor, the famous Italian tenor Caruso, used to come here to record. Campbell's Soup, one of the largest companies in the country, was here. This was a major port up until World War II. A lot of battleships were built here. I think just in the port in World War II, 35,000 people were employed. Thank you. So I'm a great admirer of the Canadian intellectual John Ralston Saul, who used the term corporate coup d'etat in his book, The Unconscious Civilization. It was a very important book for me because it gave me the vocabulary to understand that corporate coup d'etat, how it was carried out, and how it expressed itself in our society.
In 1995, writing something like that felt really risky because I was essentially saying, you know, Mussolini won the Second World War. It was his proposal, corporatism, that theoretically was defeated in the Second World War, and I was really arguing that was the way of organizing society which had become more and more powerful.
Please raise your right hand and repeat after me. I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
And I was slightly covering my bets by saying that it was a coup d'etat in slow motion because I was feeling my way into it. Nobody ever said anything like that.
When I sign this bill into law, America will have the lowest marginal tax rates and the most modern tax code among major industrialized nations.
Where I guess I was wrong was that it wasn't in slow motion. It was really very fast. When you think about it, it was really a matter of a couple of decades.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear I will faithfully execute
the office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States.
And there's no question that the coup d'etat has happened. We're well into that world. We're well into a corporatist world.
But this crisis that we're in, maybe we want to call it a legitimacy crisis, right? The status quo or the legitimating framework of capitalism, right, that has sort of guided us over the past three decades. This kind of organizing system has really lost legitimacy. The main reason is simply that it's been a project that has benefited elites enormously. And despite all of the kind of rhetoric of how much, you know, market flexibility will help workers, how much free trade will help, you know, average people become more skilled and get better jobs, the reality is ordinary working families are not doing well. In fact, they're doing substantially worse than they were doing a few decades ago.
Am I getting through to you, Mr. Beale? You get up on your little 21-inch screen and howl about America and democracy. There is no America. There is no democracy. There is only IBM and ITT and AT&T and DuPont, Dow, Union Carbide, and Exxon. Those are the nations of the world today.
So this kind of rolling coup d'etat has created a system that is, at least in its political veneer, is burlesque in character. And that gave rise to Trump. The elites, they look at Trump as an embarrassment, which he is. I mean, he's idiotic, he's narcissistic, he's incompetent, he's lazy. But Trump at least was astute enough to realize that he had to give the corporate CEOs, Wall Street, what they wanted, which was the tax cut.
Deductions that, in essence, are temporary for the middle class, but are long-term for his wealthy friends in real estate, in private equity, etc.
He gave the military a 10% budget increase, which they didn't even ask for. And he deregulated industries like the EPA. And he stacked the courts with corporate-friendly judges. And so they tolerate him.
For a number of very hardcore economic libertarians, particularly billionaires and individuals like the Koch brothers, they've made very clear since the early 70s that they would like to see a system that rewards property owners, that is a democracy that's set up to represent those with money, those with economic power. And that's the government we have today, because it's been shaped and crafted by billionaires that are hoping to ensure that democracy doesn't exist, that instead we have just a constellation of powerful interest groups.
It was basically saying individuals cannot be the source of legitimacy in society. It has to be done on the basis of self-interest. It has to be done on this basis of specialist groups. And the person who really finalized all of that, crazy though it may seem, was Mussolini. He had about half the intellectuals of Italy on his side. They came up with this idea of corporatism. In a strange kind of way, this incredible war had ended up with fundamentally the ideas of Mussolini's fascist Italy increasingly powerful and very, very handy to the sort of construction of a new kind of society. At first it wasn't noticeable, but by the time you get to the mid-70s, corporatism is back in a big way.
My fellow citizens, who are working to make America great, I salute the great American people.
It's astonishing when you read this stuff and you see the extent to which that idea of group interests versus the responsibility of the citizen has become increasingly powerful over the decades.
Better to live one day as a lion than 100 years as a sheep. That's a famous Mussolini quote. You retweeted it.
And look, Mussolini was Mussolini. It's okay to, it's a very good quote. It's a very interesting quote. And I know it. I saw it. I saw what, I know who said it. But what difference does it make, whether it's Mussolini or somebody else? It's certainly a very interesting quote.
You want to be associated with a fascist?
No, I want to be associated with interesting quotes.
I think this particular time in American history, including Trump, is one of the most important periods of the history, including the revolution. And I say that carefully as a historian, because they've run out of options. And what you see is Donald Trump is the end of the option of a corporate-dominated system. It may go to fascism. It's not at fascism yet, thankfully. The possibility of something approaching fascism, particularly if there is violence, particularly if it's in the black community, something of repression, attack on civil liberties, is certainly possible and could be very ugly. Could be very ugly.
When you have a system of power where a tiny group of people have all of it, or most of it, you have eight people who control half the wealth. When you have a tiny group of people who have all the power, you have to have some means to make sure the rest of us don't get together and take it back.
You can see that the CNN logo has been superimposed onto the other fighter's face.
What all these tweets reveal about the thinking of the most powerful man in the world and his priorities, and some would argue his humanity.
By now it is obvious that Trump is actually a bad negotiator.
This symbiotic relationship between Trump and his so-called adversaries and CNN and MSNBC, it's kind of phony when you get right down to it. I mean, CNN made $1 billion last year. Cable news companies will steadily gain and make money during the course of the election season. And then as soon as the election happens, their profits will drop off. That did not happen with Trump.
He gets two scoops of vanilla ice cream with his chocolate cream pie instead of the single scoop for everyone else.
They've continued to make money. They're making bank like never before. And Trump is definitely the reason. Everybody understands this.
Donald Trump, I believe he's a neo-fascist. He's a gangster. And he's a thug. He has no principles for the most part. He's a product of a culture of superficial spectacle. No substance. He is the culminating figure of the logic of the corporate coup d'etat, because he's in the back pockets of the financial elites. And he's very attuned to the deep white supremacist, male supremacist, homophobic and transphobic sensibilities of my fellow citizens. He continues a lot of the foreign policies of Barack Obama. He continues the Wall Street-friendly policies of Barack Obama. Thank you. He was the refined, smiling black face of the American empire. Now we've got the white know-nothing, neo-fascist face of the American empire.
Trump is the symptom. He's not the disease. The system was already so corrupt. And the anger towards the elites in both the Democratic and the Republican Party was so pronounced that his vulgarity actually gave voice to a large segment of the American public that was sick of being betrayed and lied to. We know from 2008 that the segment of the population that has suffered the most economically are African American households. Because they can put forth a black face or a woman. It functions as a brand. And that's what Obama was. Obama was a brand. And that's why, after he won in 2008, Advertising Age gave Obama its top annual award, which was Marketer of the Year.
The lone train coming through, but there used to be a ton of trains coming through here.
A lot of trains coming through?
Not anymore.
This valley has a very rich Democratic tradition. They voted Democrat almost always until President Trump came along. Kind of upset the apple cart. When I saw Hillary Clinton really struggling with trade issues and NAFTA, and I sent a 4-page memo. I predicted in that memo that she's bleeding badly blue-collar voters. And those are the voters in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin that could have turned the election. And her standing on a stage in Columbus, I mean, I don't mean to beat her up because I really do love the woman and I worked my ass off for her. But she stood on a stage in Columbus, Ohio and looked out and said,
"We're going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business.
You got a blue-collar job? F*** you." That's what they heard her say. He never came around and said, "Hey, we're going to put people out of work." He said, "Hey, I'm going to put you back to work." When people are thirsty, they're going to drink water. They don't care the water's dirty.
That wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein. Our roving producer and producer of Flashpoints in Espanol is Miguel Gavilan Molina. Our technical director is Mike Biggs. For more information about the show, to listen to or download archived episodes, log on to flashpoints.net or visit our SoundCloud page at soundcloud.com/flashpoints. For questions or comments about Flashpoints, you can contact Dennis at dennisjbernstein@gmail.com. Thank you for listening.